Morning everyone, this is Paul Angus from ShapeBlue, and his session is going to be about building a container solution with Apache Pulsec.
Hi, good morning-ish, afternoon, everyone. Come to talk about what we've called the Cloud Stack Container Service. It goes by various different names. We'll basically take you through what we've done and trying to do around containers. A quick intro to ShapeBlue, as our marketing guys insist that we say this bit, so that's us. I guess the main takeaway is building Cloud Stack, working with Cloud Stack is just our thing, that's what we do, so our focus is completely on Cloud Stack. Basically, this is saying I'm very old and have been around for longer than I look. But basically, I specialize in working with Cloud Stack and our clients, for them to deploy and work with Cloud Stack. So what they're going to actually do when they've got Cloud Stack, how they're going to leverage it to their best advantage. And we've got some nice meaty names there. So I'll quickly trundle through the kind of the people that are our customers. So the introduction to what we'll talk about, I'm going to look at why containers. It's kind of some people still asking that question, and what the container service, application cluster service that we've come up with is. A bit about what it's not, because that there is some area around there that we like to explain away. The components that make up the container service, a demonstration which I have pre-recorded to make sure it actually works, and then a bit on the roadmap and a summary at the end. We have to give kudos to Skipbox, who we worked with, and you will, their thing is really Kubernetes. And we started off, I'll talk about it a bit more, and decided Kubernetes was probably the best way to go, and certainly it's proving that way. So we did a lot of work with Skipbox on understanding how Kubernetes worked and what it would require from Cloud Stack. He was at the time pretty much the outgoing VP of Cloud Stack, but Sebastian is Skipbox largely. He was the driving force in that company, so we spent a lot of time renewing acquaintances with Sebastian and working on the project. It was great to see him, and he's alive and well and doing very well in his new project. So we get to the why of it, and basically, we were a bit too early in this, so I did almost this talk, it's been updated since, but this talk a year ago when we were really excited that we'd done this container thing and we were showing it off, and everyone was saying to us, yeah, because everyone's going to be using containers, And from the people we would sell Cloud Stack to, or people we would support using Cloud Stack, the key word there was going to. And what we found was we produced this and everyone went, that's great, as soon as we've decided what we're going to do about containers, we'll come see you. A year later, that's actually happening. While the growth has been happening in the background, it's still taken a long time for people to catch up and want to use that in their cloud. People who would use Cloud Stack or any of those other orchestration tools are now really saying, okay, well, we've been thinking about it and we decided, yes, we do need to do it. The drivers were obvious to the end users, but less so to the people who then supply them with their cloud. But the key concepts, obviously, is that you're looking at your application rather than worrying about your actual virtual machines. They are much more lightweight things than virtual machines, and generally would have a faster startup time. I mean, the reality is that a container can be as small or large as you want, so it isn't true to say that they are necessarily like lightning starting, it just depends how you've done it and how you've configured it in the first place. But the problem is that kind of in the container world, multi-tenancy is a bit more of an afterthought. It's not built in the same way as where we've put our nice wrappers around virtual machines. In Cloud Stack, we've done that through network isolation or through IP tables and basic zones where you've got security groups. We've solved what we were going to do with isolation there, but containers is a whole different ball game. And the other part where CloudStack lives, which is the IaaS, that's a VMware-based business. Everything's thought of in terms of the virtual machine, how many you've got, how big they are, how much you're charging for them. That's the way we think. And a VM is obviously generally much longer lived than a container. So how everyone was trying to wrap their head around, how on earth am I going to charge for a container which would be inside a VM, which could live for, have a lifespan of seconds or minutes, rather than days and months and years. So there were a lot of challenges that we hoped we could try and help with. The model we came up with was based on the same model you'll see in Google and Amazon, is it? And obviously they had pretty much the same problem of trying to work out that they work in virtual machines, but containers really are not a very friendly thing to try and cost and charge for. The other part we looked at is by doing it the way I'll demonstrate, there's no disruption to the user experience, and more importantly, for uptake within CloudStack, no real disruption to the business. It's not a sudden big change in how you're billing. It's not a big change in how people are consuming things. So the business can carry on selling as it was before. Obviously, it's got a new service in there, but it means there's an easy path, an easy migration from one to including the other, rather than saying, okay, well, now everything's containers and that's all I can support. So that's where we get to. The users are still paying in this model for their underlying virtual machines, the infrastructure itself, and that keeps everyone kind of happy. We built this on obviously CloudStack. We took the decision again about a year ago that we were going to start off with Kubernetes. That's where we thought most looked the biggest player at the time and the direction most people have been wanting to go. I think that's been borne out. I think about, someone told me a statistic about 90% of all container workloads run on Kubernetes at the moment. I think that came from the guys at Rancher who see across the stack of different containers. They were looking at about 90% of what actually goes on is Kubernetes. And it's still got to run on something, so we picked CoreOS for effectively the VM template, because that runs Kubernetes out of the box. It's relatively light, and it is still an operating system of choice for those kind of loads. I said, talk about what it's not. Trying to find a kind of neutral picture of a dictator was problematic, because I could see me getting myself on several blacklists if I actually picked a live or even dead one. So we are not dictating the CloudStack container solution, and we'll talk about the framework in a moment. But the framework allows for multiple different things. They don't even have to be container solutions. It could be a database as a service type thing. And I'll explain more about that in a moment. So the architecture we've created was one of, it's going to be a cluster of virtual machines that will run this cluster of nodes. Our starting point, our kind of implementation, will then be done to support Kubernetes. So the two were done in parallel with the plan that the framework itself, if you like, would be extensible. Dan's here, who has been doing a lot of work on that and working with the community on what that might look like. So to look at some of the components that make this up, we have this applications cluster framework. The idea that there will be a group of virtual machines that will live together. They are a cluster, and we need to manage them as a cluster and make CloudStack aware of that and have APIs that understand that. More about that in a second. From our side, then, we added on, and the work with Skipbox was about how to deploy Kubernetes onto that group of virtual machines. what Kubernetes needed to know about CloudStack, what CloudStack needed to know about Kubernetes, and how to inject that into the virtual machines when they come up, these CoreOS templates, so that they then become a cluster of VMs that are running Kubernetes as a whole. We also had to create a certificate service. I'll talk a bit more about that in a moment, because you need secure connections to the dashboard that Kubernetes spins up, and for that you need a certificate. So we had to build a lightweight certificate service in CloudStack to take that forward. And then we also added on a bit more of UI to simplify the interaction with the clusters, to give ease of use for, if you like, relatively beginner, if you like, Kubernetes people. Most people are going to be using kubectl, the command line tool, to actually interact with their Kubernetes clusters, but it's always nice to be able to see something and be able to poke it a bit before you have to start typing War and Peace to make it do anything. So, going through those, we created this new application cluster API. This is snippets from it. And the thing I'll point out here is this idea of a role within there. So the way, and type in fact, and the way we try to, or are trying to at the moment, abstract out what this cluster of VMs might do is the idea of a type and a role within that type. So Kubernetes wants one or two masters and then a load of worker nodes. But that model doesn't really suit a Galera cluster, which has just however many master nodes, and wouldn't suit a Mesos cluster or a Cassandra cluster. They all work differently. So what we're doing is pulling that out and making it so you can define what those roles are and how many of each you want. And that's where this pluggable architecture comes in. We'll see the use of the service offering and the count and account names and stuff that we've done in our actual implementation in the demonstration. And then a few more of those APIs that we've got in there where we can manipulate how those roles and do stuff with the actual cluster themselves. We've got, I mentioned the certificate service. So now the management server has the ability, when it all merged in, to act as a certificate authority, creating client and server certificates and basically enabling the secure connections that we needed to be able to allow people through the UI to get to the Kubernetes dashboard in the first place. So that was the original intent of it, but now we're looking to expand that certificate service out to being able to secure other internal communications by CloudStack. And that's work we're just kind of specking out at the moment. But this certificate service, as we're porting it into CloudStack, we're kind of keeping that in mind, that it's going to do more than just the original intent that we had with the Kubernetes side. Okay. So, in terms of the functionality, we started off with our plugin that orchestrates that deployment of of Kubernetes within those CentOS nodes that we're deploying. We then create the secure access to the Kubernetes API endpoint and to its dashboard. So Kubernetes has its own dashboard. It runs as a container, so we start that container up within those nodes and give you direct access to it. So we do a little bit of orchestration of the network that we create to pass through port 443 from the public interfaces back to the Kubernetes master nodes. We also get you access to the virtual machines as well. And in the kind of normal CloudStack sense, it acts as the control plane, the plugin. So it's not in the data path, switching the CloudStack management server off like the rest of CloudStack, the VMs and the hypervisors will carry on working, so will your containers. It's just that that particular control plane is not available. You would still be able to go through the using kubectl, which I'll show, and manipulate your clusters. Your clusters would be running and connected to the internet if they were. So we've kept it as just a control plane. There's the demo, but I don't think that actually comes next. So I'll look. Yeah. So you'd start off before with the components that you'd normally see in CloudStack. We've got the guest VM, the virtual router, all of those parts. What we've added on here is the so bits in blue. So to the CloudStack UI, I mentioned, we'll see it in a second, some extra features and functions. Then two bits, if you like, of API. One that's working directly with the larger cluster, the application cluster or container cluster in this case, that's creating those virtual machines, having them running, stopping them. And a second part, which actually connects to Kubernetes master node itself, allowing the control of the cluster from within. So we've done kind of two parts of plumbing. One, so the framework that we talk about is this outer piece, and then the plugin would be the inner piece at the same time. And said via the virtual router, we've allowed access in. So if you were using kubectl, you would be able to directly go through to your Kubernetes master. We generate a strong password on instantiation of the Kubernetes group, and then show that in the UI for the users to actually connect to. Now the bit that says is demonstration, and one hopes this works. About a moist press play on the bottom. So I'll come around here to watch. Logging in to a standard cloud stack, as I clear that off. As you can see, I'm just showing this. It's basically a normal cloud stack. This one was a 4.6, I think, with the plugin installed on it. And we've got this container service extra tab, which I think will say application service when it's completed. But in there, we've got our cluster, and just demonstrate, we've got basic information about that cluster in there. If I scroll down, we've got, very quickly, we'll come back to that. So adding a container cluster, I'll do a demonstrate here. Name and description are whatever they are, the zone we're creating it. The service offering will be all the service offerings that you have available in that zone, in that cloud. So that's the size of the worker nodes, how big they're actually going to be. So the compute resources you give per node. Network will either create a new one or use an existing one. And cluster size means the number of worker nodes. It's the number of nodes that are going to do actual computation. We will create an additional node, which is the master node, at the same time, but we don't include that in your size. And we had the option there to create SSH keys or use SSH keys, because CoreOS doesn't allow password authentication. You've got to do it through keys, so you can supply them. Looking down here, you can see we give the API endpoint and a dashboard endpoint, as well as the username. And unfortunately, because the screen's broken, you can't see the password is down the bottom there. I'll skip over the dashboard and come back to that in a second. Here are my instances running. We've got three, so that's two workers and a master. And you can see from the firewall, what we've created is port 443 being allowed through and being sent to that master. So if you use port 443, you'll go there. So here's the certificate that you need. So we prompt you to install that because you need the client certificate to be able to connect. And you can see this has come up, and these are the internal services that Kubernetes runs automatically or has in out of the box that we've enabled and switched on. So Kubernetes internal DNS and its internal service for the dashboard. So what I'm going to just show here is if I go to Docker Hub, well, we support private registries, which most people are going to want in real life going to want to use. But to show we're not kind of cheating here and having stuff set up before, I'm just going to pull stuff straight from a Docker Hub to run. So these are just stuff you can download straight from Docker. There are, God knows how many hundreds, thousands of, I think some tens of thousands of applications people upload there to use. So I'm calling it my Ghost, so I'm going to install Ghost. I'm going to put it on two pods, I'm going to tell it that I want it exposed externally and give it a port number, which I think is hard-coded by Ghost itself, so Ghost runs on that port, so that's what I've got to tell it, tell Kubernetes that's where it's going to come out. So I'll set that off, and I've, so far I've got 0 of 2, but it will add those in, and to be a bit more clever about the whole thing, I'm going to add a second application at the same time. I'm going to do an Nginx application in there. Typing all that in. And say this is it's a demonstration. Very few people's applications, I think, are going to include Ghost and Nginx downloaded from there. It looks like I've stuck with one pod, fortunately. But we'll see how we get around that. There's lots of additional information you can set, but for the purposes of this, I don't need to. Obviously, you would unlikely use the dashboard for any real hardcore applications you're wanting to do, but this is a handy way to be able to go in and see what's happening. Now, I need access to those applications. Chances are you're not going to give access to every single application you're running because you'll have a whole stack. You'll have the web server being accessed from outside and everything else hidden. But for this, allowing my port 80 and 81 so I can actually get in and demonstrate that stuff works. I'm going to do this using load balancing so that if one of my pods goes down, it's a distributed application, it won't matter. And in fact, because I've only done one pod of Nginx, I already have one of them down because I've got to go find it. Now, in my services, I need to go find the port that is being exposed on internally by Kubernetes. So this pauses me writing that down and, in this case, trying to get the pen to work if I didn't want to. So I've got 31077 for that one and 32024 for that one. Fortunately, I've seen the end of this video, so I know it actually works. So once I've written those down, I can go to my load balancing and start creating my rules. So I'll use 80 as the external port, that's what's allowed for the firewall, and put that through to my UARM, decided to go for that, and the VMs, and I have my two worker nodes, maybe one or two, the last one is the master. Again, just checking that I get the right two nodes. There we go. So they're up, they know where they're trying to connect to, and we're off. So I hope I double check to make sure it's up. Yep, so I've got my pods up and running, so I'm happy. to demonstrate, here's my networks, and what I need to know here is that IP address, because that's the public IP address that everything's being exposed via. So I get that, type that in there, port 80, moment of truth. Yes, Ghost is running on port 80, same one, partner in, 81. And the NGINX is running on there. So, I've got these up and running. It's taking next to no time. It is a slightly trivial setup, but it still demonstrates the point. And just to look in here, this time I've gone through the network tab, and what you'll see is there. This is just basically the same thing that you saw before. So we've not done anything kind of funny in there with the container service and that tab. All we've done is exposed the same thing, but made it easier than going into networks, going into doing all the stuff I had to do up there to get there. And you can obviously from there set up whatever kind of load balancing you want with what we have available in CloudStack. And you can see all my nodes as instances there.
So, and that should be the end of that. Seems to be the end of that. So to summarize that video, we created the cluster, container cluster with the three VMs in it. Had a look at the dashboard that was auto-deployed, auto-started up with the certificates created so that I was able to connect to it. Otherwise, I'd have got certificate errors and you can't see this because it's not encrypted type stuff. Deployed two, high availability, one not, containerized application. Created all the firewall rules to expose them and then just access the applications to show it worked. So there's quite a roadmap that we want to do. I'll explain where we are on that in a moment. So automating exposing of those services to public internet, there's already partly been done because part of the work that Skipbox did is they had a CloudStack provider, they wrote a CloudStack provider for Kubernetes in Kubernetes so that Kubernetes clusters are actually aware of the idea of CloudStack and can open up ports to networking ports via the application in Kubernetes. So you can do a kubectl command that'll actually open these services up from the inside. We'd also like to link that up because we have communications with the master node, be able to list the services that you've created in there and just say which services would you like to expose and automate that part and make that a bit more slick. Resizing of clusters will be more part of the actual container, the application cluster work, and auto-scaling of clusters. I'm not sure if anyone's doing it yet. I know I was super excited about that last year. A lot when we were wanting to do this, definitely Amazon and Google didn't offer that, that you could auto-scale these clusters based on demand. So you'd set your limits, and then as the you just then concentrated on your containers and the amount of things you wanted to run in them, as that continued on, you would CloudStack would effectively be sizing the clusters within certain limits to match what you wanted to do. Nice housekeeping things like being able to upgrade the Kubernetes version from CloudStack. It's something that Google offers that we wanted to include. The sizing of the master node. In this first iteration, the master node was the same size as the worker nodes, but with the work Dan's doing, actually they'll be independent and we'll be able to size them. But we'll probably either need to pass that to the user to decide how big their worker needs to be or give them a way of figuring that out or an algorithm that figures it out for them. By having the roles that we spoke of, we'll be able to say we want two master nodes. At the moment it's just set up for one. When you have two master nodes, you want that set up as HA. So we'll be pushing that configuration in as well. ECD data stores will be important. Using anti-affinity groups would be obviously quite useful. It depends on people's use cases. Some people may want their cluster to be as compact as possible, running in a single cluster to have as minimal latency between the parts of the application. But other people will say, well, I want these spread out as much as possible because I don't want a failure in one cluster to affect my whole application. That's the whole point. I want it distributed. So being able to enforce one way or the other would be very helpful. When we first wrote this, data persistency, the actual volumes, data volumes, was just being launched by Kubernetes. So we want to catch up with that. At the time, we just said, well, we've got to draw a line, so it's not yet in production, so we won't support that. And an interesting one, I think, is it Rafael, are you doing about PaaS, Metal as a Service later? Is someone? No.
What?
I guess that's a no. Someone's doing a talk on Metal as, Saeed, yeah. Saeed's doing a talk on Metal as a Service, which I want to go and watch, because Bare Metal's not been great up till now, but if you combine the idea of the container service and then we're orchestrating the Bare Metal deployment of CoreOS, for instance, you suddenly you can say, well, CloudStack now orchestrating just Bare Metal containers, or the containers for the containers, that will suit a lot of people's use cases as well, because you'll be able to combine this into a single, you've got the single pane of glass of your cloud with actual Bare Metal container kind of workloads as well. So it'll be a win-win all around. So I spoke of time frame. So we originally wrote this as a separate plugin with the view that we were going to contribute back the framework part, and probably, because not everyone wants to run necessarily Kubernetes, we would try and have a separate open source the Kubernetes part, but it wouldn't be part of CloudStack core, but it'd still be available hopefully by via the CloudStack community. So that's the kind of end game we're there. We have open sourced all of the work anyway. Dan, as I say, is working to get the framework contributed. I stuck it as a tiny URL because it's the actual PR and the wiki link is enormous. As I say, the plugin is open source anyway, so you can just download it and install it on 4.5 and 4.6 right now. And that other roadwork stuff that I mentioned, basically what we're working on, it, let's get it into CloudStack as it is with the work Dan's doing, and then we'll look at all the separate features that we wanted to do and go back to them. But to do them now while we're putting it into CloudStack is going to be a bit of wasted effort probably. Rattling through that. Finally, any questions on that right now?
I do SSL proxying to have multiple management servers. So I actually have an AJ proxy that where the SSH session terminates, or sorry, yep. SSL session terminates, yeah. And it goes from there. How does that affect the dashboard plugin? Are you going to get an SSL error? Is it an iframe? I mean, how is that?
It's an iframe, which is why it needs to have the certificate. Mm-hmm. So as the user, I think as the user downloads the certificate,
okay.
They aren't actually going through the management server, they're going through the virtual router.
Okay.
They're going through the public interface of the virtual router directly to their own Kubernetes node.
Okay.
So it would bypass that completely.
Okay. So if I have like a wildcard certificate, which is what I have now, with the console proxy and everything else, then they're going to get an SSL, hey, this is not a,
If they didn't have the certificate, they would get a, hey, this isn't secure.
Yeah.
If this is an insecure frame in a secure frame, you can't do that.
Yeah.
So that's why they have to have the certificate to get around that.
Okay. And then the second question that you mentioned about 4.5.4.6, what's the plans on putting that like in the 4.9 LTS or anything like that?
It's a new feature, so it wouldn't go in back to LTS.
Mm-hmm.
But it's been developed at the moment. It won't be 4.10, so I guess 4.11 hopefully it will be where we see all the container, all the application part of it, and then we just bolt our bit on top.
Okay.
Yeah?
Present stable CCS is ported to 4.10 to B,
mm-hmm.
but we can't release it yet because 4.10 is not released, so there's a new plugin that will be compatible with 4.10.
Okay.
Right.
The old one, it should work on 4.9, but we never tested it.
Now, I think in my lab I installed it on a 4.8 box, and it worked.
Okay.
In my lab, but I don't have it in production, because I'm running 4.9.2 in production.
Yeah. So it's something that should work.
Should.
Anyone else? Awesome. Thank you very much for your time. The slides go up on SlideShare.